Often on Good Friday, we focus on the very graphic first reading from Isaiah. This is the fourth of his servant songs, they're called, and we really see the suffering servant in that first reading. But often it's this very graphic first reading and the dramatic passion narrative that grab our attention. And that makes sense, because that's the core. That's the core. Remember, well, I wasn't here last Sunday, but last Sunday I told it was in Browning. There's a saying that says that the Gospels are all about, well, I can't remember the saying now, but basically the Gospels are long narratives for the passion narratives is what the Gospels are all about. I don't know why I can't remember the, but they have long introductions to these passion narratives. And so the fact that we're focusing on the passion narratives is totally reasonable, right? But it's easy for us to overlook that second reading, that marvelous second reading from Hebrews, which actually sets the context and gives us the key for unlocking the beauty and the true meaning of Christ's sacrifice. And so we're going to dig into it a little bit. Since, as we heard, Christ offered prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to the only one who was able to save him from death, and since he also learned obedience from what he suffered, his prayers were answered in the most marvelous way. He was made perfect, we heard, and in doing so, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. This is wonderful stuff. And therefore, his brutal death is not meaningless or fruitless. Rather, it is eternally fruitful and life-giving. Through Christ's sacrifice, we are now able to confidently approach the throne of grace, to receive mercy, and to find grace for timely help, as we also heard from that reading. And all of us need this timely help, this saving grace and mercy. But what exactly is the throne of grace? What are we talking about here? In short, it's God's throne in heaven. That's where all the grace comes from. Yet, it is very accessible to us here on earth, first and foremost through the sacraments, which are the primary fonts of God's grace and offer us the most intimate experience of God's love this side of heaven. It all starts with baptism. It's called the gateway sacrament. And this is our immersion into the life of God. And we're immersed through the waters, through those saving waters, death to any speck of sin we have on our souls, and we rise to new life in the Lord. So it all starts with baptism. It's so crucially important. And then it's lived out in a regular and ongoing way through the other six sacraments, but primarily through regular confession and the Eucharist every Sunday and on holy days and on days during the Paschal Triduum, of which this is the second day. And so what's going on here is this is our obedience to the Lord. And it leads to what? It leads to conversion, transformation, freedom. Just like we see with Jesus. That's what his suffering leads to. And now with this foundation in place, our experience of the throne of grace is deepened through a life of daily prayer. So critical. And yes, this might involve devotions and prayer cards and things like that. Totally fine. But it must also ultimately involve personal conversation with God. This is developing that beautiful and intimate relationship that he's given us through the sacraments, starting in baptism, nurtured, confession, Eucharist, and so on and so forth. And then our life of daily prayer helps us to deepen this experience. So it's important that we have that personal conversation with God in addition to our devotional practices. And then last but not least, we come to the throne of grace through self-emptying love for others. This reminds us of last night's gospel passage, which is John's version of the Last Supper, and where he really stresses that charity. Jesus washes the feet of the disciples there. And so this is the self-emptying love that flows from our participation in the sacraments, our life of daily prayer. And then we go out according to God's will to love and to serve our brothers and sisters. In a word, this is mission. Mission. So, be humble enough to recognize your constant need for the Lord, which comes because of sin, and we're all sinners. And then, like Jesus, obediently turn to the only one who can save you from eternal death. And that's God. The trouble is that often we aren't doing this. We aren't turning to the only one who can save us from eternal death. We're turning to other things, false gods, so to speak. And so Jesus asks us too, whom are you looking for? Remember, right at the beginning of the Passion narrative, are you looking for Jesus, the big teddy bear, who you just give him a hug every now and again, and it's so nice and cuddly, and everything is magically better? How about Jesus, the buddy? You give Jesus a high five. Jesus is my homeboy. You know, he's awesome. Somehow everything's okay just because of that. What about Jesus, the magician? It's like he's got a magic wand. Poof. And all of a sudden, everything's great. You're immediately going to heaven, no matter what you've done in this life, even if you don't change your life. What about Jesus, the guru? Jesus is, he's like the best teacher ever, and he's just this really morally upright man, and we just really look up to him. But he's way off. He's unachievable. He's just too idealistic. Is that the Jesus that you're looking for? Or Jesus, the obedient, suffering servant and the Savior of the world? Jesus, the Savior, requires us to follow him and make changes in our lives, but only so we can flourish now in this life and join him in heaven in due time. His sacrifice and his teachings don't actually benefit him at all. He's eternally happy in heaven, whether we follow him or not. His teachings and his sacrifice, they're all gift for us. They only benefit us. So we should walk along with him, right? God isn't expecting us to do something so he benefits. He's doing things so that we benefit. A little later on in their Passion narrative, Jesus also says to each one of us, shortly before he dies on the cross, I thirst. And what is he talking about here? Does he want a Mountain Dew, you think? Or does he want a bottle of water? No. I mean, he's probably parched, right? I mean, he hasn't had anything since the previous night to drink, and he's been beaten and all kinds of things. So he's probably thirsty, like, you know, for water, but he's thirsting for us. That's what he's thirsting for. But what do we give him? Just like they do in the gospel narrative, we give him vinegar to drink. We give him sour wine. And what does he give us in return? He gives us his own precious blood. His saving blood. He yearns for each of us to yearn for him with our whole hearts. How will you respond? And finally, right before he dies, Jesus says, it is finished. It is finished. And indeed, his work as a human being here on earth was finished at that very point. But something much, much greater and more beautiful has only just begun. It's only just begun. The church has been instituted. Think about that interchange that Jesus has with Mary and John, where he says, Mother, or woman, rather, behold your son. Then he turns to the disciple, behold your mother. That's the beginning of the church right there. It's what's going on. And then very soon after this, we have blood and water flow from his side. And this is the wellspring of the sacraments. The water represents baptism. The blood represents Jesus' precious blood, the Eucharist. And so this is what the church offers to us. So he institutes the church, and then here's the wellspring of the church, of his grace springing up through the church. We see it all right there. And so during this dark and grim hour, we catch glimmers of an entirely new way of life that will explode into the world with the resurrection. And we know Jesus is going to show up. Now he's going to have a glorified body. And it's going to be marvelous. We'll save that for Sunday, though. For now, will you accept these wonderful gifts that he's offering and begin to radically live this marvelous new life with him, this new life of resurrection? Okay, brothers and sisters, the crucial question remains, Whom are you looking for? Christ thirsts so deeply for you and for me. Do you thirst deeply for him? Or just for him on the surface level, kind of a superficial relationship with him? Are you willing to regularly approach the throne of grace for timely help? Or will you avoid the change and transformation that his grace brings about and therefore empty the cross of its power and meaning? That's why he went to the cross. Christ is literally offering you everything at this very moment. Will you open up the depths of your heart to him, accept his offering, and follow him? He chose to wear a crown of thorns for you so that you might wear the crown of glory. Will you accept this crown from him?